Kia ora and welcome to the Week in Review. I'm Paul Brennan with a selection of stories and interviews in RNZ News this week. Coming up in this podcast, 40 years on from Erebus. Two former prime ministers are backing calls to move Auckland's used carport to Whangarei. And Wellingtonians may think they know a thing or two about gusts and gales, but the community of Castle Point, home of a howling southerly and wind-whipped sand, would like a word.
I think this month has been pretty bad. Last night, I think we had a gust of 140, and it didn't seem that windy because earlier in the month, I think there was a gust of 190.
Coming up in the Week in Review. But first, after a harrowing 3.5 week trial, a jury took just 3 hours to find former Dunedin doctor Venod Scantha guilty of murdering 16-year-old Amber Rose Rush. The teenager was found by her mother in her bed in a pool of blood on February the 3rd last year. The jury returned a unanimous verdict, as well as finding him guilty of 4 counts of threatening to kill. Outside the High Court at Dunedin, Miss Rush's father, Shane Rush, spoke to the media.
The family would like to thank the police, the detectives for all their hard work. Also to the judge, the jury and the prosecution for the time and effort it took to get some justice for our beautiful young hero. This has been such a horrendous time for us all. For all the family, we are very thankful for everyone out there who has helped us individually and as a family to get here. The taking of Amber Rose's life has affected our family in every way. Two family members are now gone, and everyone else somehow has to find a way to move on.
Miss Rush's mother, Lisa, died of a suspected suicide in June last year, a few months after her daughter's murder. During the trial, the Crown called 69 witnesses and put more than 1,000 pages of evidence before the jury. In contrast, the defence called no one and offered no evidence. Justice Nation thanked the jury.
All those involved in this trial value the importance in this country of a fair trial. But in the end, it was you who had the difficult and demanding responsibility of making a decision, of reaching a verdict on the evidence. You accepted that responsibility. So on behalf of the community, thank you.
Our Otago Southland reporter, Timothy Brown, sat through much of the evidence. He joined Susie Ferguson on Thursday's morning report.
Venod Scantha found guilty. What's next?
Well, what's next is he'll be sentenced in March next year. On March the 6th, he'll come back before Justice Gerald Nation to face his sentence for the murder of Amber Rose Rush. And those 4 counts of threatening to kill, that's relating to the prosecution's key witness and his family. Now, that sentence is likely to take place under Section 104 of the Sentencing Act. That's a part of the Act that deals with a particularly brutal level of murder. Now, there's 10 criteria under Section 104 by which someone will then be imposed with a 17-year minimum non-parole period. Now, Scantha's crime ticks the box of about 4 of those 10 criteria. That was, he carried it out to avoid detection of another crime. The murder involved unlawful entry into Miss Rush's home. It was committed with a high level of brutality. And the deceased was particularly vulnerable because of their age. She was only 16 years old. Now, 17 is the minimum non-parole period that will be imposed if he is seen by the judge to have met that criteria. It could be longer if there are other aggravating factors.
Now, just talk us through the Crown's case and the key evidence there.
Well, the Crown's case is that Scantha and Miss Rush shared a terse message exchange on social media on the day of February the 2nd. That exchange ultimately led to Mr. Scantha panicking that she was going to go forward to the police and his bosses at the Southern DHB with claims he was touching up minors, supplying them alcohol and offering money for sex. Now, Scantha already was on thin ice with the Southern DHB after showing up to work while off duty in July 2017 and treating a patient despite being off duty and despite having 2 beers at lunchtime. The Crown says as a result of that, he acted on an impulse, and at some time around about 11:30 on February the 2nd, he went and picked up a young teenage friend who then gave him directions to Miss Rush's bedroom within her home and the location of a spare key to gain entry to the house. Scantha then entered the home and stabbed her to death shortly before midnight, taking her phone to try and cover up the incriminating evidence it contained.
Now, what was the alternative put forward by the defence?
The defence says that no, it wasn't Scantha that carried out the murder, that it was the teenage friend of Scantha, the prosecution's key witness, a young boy with name suppression. Now, the defence says that he carried out this crime without Scantha's knowledge and I guess in some way must have been within the company of Scantha, because we know Scantha went to pick up this young boy. He was in his company from 11:40 till the Sunday following, February the 4th, and that during that time, the defence claims that the young boy entered her home and out of some place, some misplaced sense of loyalty to Scantha, to confront Miss Rush over the post she was making on social media, and then lost control. However, it doesn't account for all the evidence that points back to Scantha, the blood in his car, on his side of the car where he was seated, the fire that he held down at his ex-girlfriend's house the next day, where clothes were burnt, clothes that he claimed were just daggy clothes, but that the young witness says were the bloody clothes from the murder, the weapon being one that is consistent with what the young witness told police, a knife taken from Scantha's home, and ultimately the cell phone being discarded.
Now, the accused's demeanour in court, what was that like?
He has been calm and polite throughout much of the trial. He's well-dressed. He certainly cuts a different figure to the man that we saw almost 22 months ago who appeared in court, quite dishevelled. He's cleaned up. He's slimmed down also. He's been well-dressed. He has greeted the corrections guards with a politeness every day. He's offered them drinks of water. He's been intently staring at every witness and every moment of evidence, and that was when the demeanour really changed. Last week, on Friday, when his police interview was played to the court. Now, this is a man who has steered holes through every witness that has sat in the stand, but when his video interview with police were played, he closed his eyes, he looked down, he didn't look at that video for a single moment. And that was a real change in his demeanour from what we've seen throughout the trial.
Now, what about the police or the defence? Did they have anything to say after the verdict?
The police and the defence both hurriedly left court yesterday after the verdict was announced. Police indicated they will be willing to make some kind of statement after sentencing. The defence, on the other hand, offered no comment. Now, the only issue that can arise between here and sentence is whether there will be an appeal process against the conviction. Now, the defence didn't make that clear yesterday. However, during his closing remarks, defence lawyer Jonathan Eden QC did indicate that he is uncomfortable with some of the evidence that was introduced during the trial. This is evidence that relates to Scantha's pattern of sexual predatory behaviour towards young women. Now, none of the other witnesses that came forward were minors in the sense that they were under 16, but they were young. They were late teens to early 20s. And he said that this evidence was introduced simply to blacken the character of Scantha, that it holds no real relevance to the trial itself, that the jury has to reach the conclusion that when Scantha went to kill Miss Rush, that in the back of his mind was these other claims such as groping of a young woman who continued to party at his house, and he would grope her and she would, in unpolite terms, tell him to stop and go away. And this carried on over a period of months. Jonathan Eden says this has the thinnest of veneer of relevance to the case. However, the judge ruled that it's admissible and that the jury needs to hear it because it offers propensity evidence. That is a pattern of Scantha's behaviour leading up in the months before Miss Rush's death.
Just finally, is he still a doctor?
Mr. Scantha has not been able to practice since the 28th of February last year. That was shortly after he was charged. He was charged on February 4th. And at that moment, the medical council stopped Scantha from practicing as soon as possible. Now, a professional conduct committee has been established to investigate the allegations against Scantha, and obviously yesterday they were proven by the jury. That professional conduct committee investigation was placed on hold, awaiting the outcome of this trial. That investigation will now resume immediately, and an option available to that committee is to file a charge in the Health Practitioner's Disciplinary Tribunal. If Scantha is found to be convicted of an offence which reflects adversely on his fitness to practice, that tribunal can cancel Scantha's registration.
That's our Otago Southland reporter, Timothy Brown, on Morning Report. The Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern, has apologised wholeheartedly to the families of the 257 people lost in the Erebus disaster for the first time in a ceremony marking the 40th anniversary of the flight. Both the government, which was in full ownership of Air New Zealand at the time, and the airline itself have unequivocally apologised. Almost 500 family members of Erebus victims were at Government House in Auckland for Thursday's ceremony. Families have welcomed the apology as a weight off their shoulders and say it's a huge relief. Our reporter Jordan Bond filed this report for Thursday's Checkpoint program.
40 years since New Zealand's greatest loss of life outside of a war, and the grief remains. One major loose end was resolved today. The first full apology from the government and the airline for failures which led to the deaths of 257 people.
And the time has come to end piecemeal acknowledgements. After 40 years, on behalf of today's government, the time has come to apologise for the actions of an airline then in full state ownership, which ultimately caused the loss of the aircraft and the loss of those you loved. This apology is wholehearted and wide-reaching. We will never know your grief, but I know the time has come to say I'm sorry.
A sense of relief washed over Dan Maloney. His father, Nick Maloney, was the flight engineer on TE-901.
It was special. I just about had tears in my eyes when they started talking about an apology, you know. It was emotional. It sort of... spiritual. It was incredible. So thank you, Jacinda, and thank you to the chair at Air New Zealand.
Air New Zealand has never apologised in full for its role in the country's worst peacetime loss of life. It apologised for what it did or didn't do afterwards, but not for the crash itself. Today, that changed.
I apologise on behalf of an airline which 40 years ago failed in its duty of care to its passengers and staff. And I apologise again on behalf of the airline for the way in which the families of those lost on Mount Erebus were treated in the aftermath of the incident.
The speech from Dame Therese Walsh, the chair of Air New Zealand, came as a surprise today, as it wasn't in the rundown.
The Air New Zealand of today is not the Air New Zealand in 1979. The Prime Minister of today is not the Prime Minister of 1979. It's a significant event, a formal apology from the Prime Minister of New Zealand and also from the Chair of Air New Zealand. For my family, it's a weight off our shoulders.
Ms Ardern says the time was right for an apology, but after 40 years of family's frustration, she wasn't sure how they'd react.
I wasn't sure how necessarily it would be received. There's so much understandable grief, and it's hard for any of us to fathom what the past 40 years would have felt like for them. So to be honest, I did not know how an apology today would be received. All I knew was it was the right thing to do.
A memorial was also held at Scott Base today and Auckland Airport. However, a permanent public memorial in Auckland's Parnell is in limbo. It was meant to be finished by today for the anniversary, but ongoing delays over the last couple of years and now a stoush over its location is holding it up. Auckland Mayor Phil Gough spoke plainly about his views.
We hope that 40 years later we will finally have a memorial, a place where people can go to express their feelings and to remember. And I would certainly urge members of the local community and the local board to look favourably on the proposal that we have put forward.
Jordan Bond with that report from Checkpoint. Maria Collins, widow of pilot Captain Jim Collins, says that while she always thought there would eventually be an official apology, she didn't think it would come within her lifetime. She joined Susie Ferguson on Friday's Morning Report.
So I guess you've had a bit of time to process all of this and have it sink in. What was it like for you to hear those words?
Complete shock. But it did vindicate what so many hundreds of New Zealanders, let alone my legal team and others who wrote books on it, like Stuart McFarlane, the late Gordon Vetti, and Sir Paul Holmes, also kept telling me. It was hard to believe. I truly was delighted and very shocked and surprised when it happened yesterday.
So you had no sense that this was on the cards for yesterday? No. When it began, when when the speech took that turn. Tell us about what that was like for you.
Well, I couldn't believe it. I thought I was in a dream. One day I'd wake up and that's what I'd love to hear. But of course it was never going to happen in my lifetime, and I was going to wake up and it'd all be gone. And there it was, and I was quite shocked myself to actually hear those words.
Now you've had a bit of time to absorb it. Is it becoming any more real?
Of course it's becoming more real. It's something that I believed deep in my heart many, many years ago, from the first comments that people made, like Captain Gordon Beatty, the late Captain Gordon Beatty, who was Jim's training captain, and who said, "Not Jim Collins. Anybody else but Jim Collins, nobody would have an accident if Jim Collins was on that flight." So he said to me, "There's got to be something more to this." As I waited and waited, and all I got were hundreds and hundreds of calls and well wishes saying, "We will never blame the pilot." And I thought that was a wonderful way that New Zealanders helped us in those terrible early hours of that first day.
And coming,
it's been like that always.
And coming now, 40 years on, I mean, after such a huge period of time has elapsed, you said you never thought it would come in your lifetime. It has.
It has. And that's a miracle in itself. And I can only say I'm truly grateful for our family and for us. I can hardly speak with the emotion of what it means to us.
This apology, though, is it an admission of liability? Does it open the way for any kind of legal action?
Susie, we haven't gone down there yet. We're still digesting this moment, and we'll have to see whether or if or not at all that's something that we don't yet, haven't even considered. So conjecture is one thing, but we're just savouring the moment of the Prime Minister's words.
This sounds, the way you're talking, your voice is full of emotion. This sounds like this has to be one of the most momentous parts of your life.
Well, it is quite eloquently put. Yes, indeed, it is. And I didn't believe it could happen.
Maria Collins, widow of the pilot of Flight 901, Captain Jim Collins, speaking on Morning Report. And the daughter of the flight engineer killed in the Erebus crash says the apology on Thursday has lifted a weight she's been shouldering since she was a schoolgirl, worrying her dad may have done something to cause the accident. Virginia Brooks' father, Gordon Brooks, was the Air New Zealand flight engineer on board Flight 901 40 years ago. The Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern, issued a wholehearted and wide-reaching apology on behalf of the airline and government for both failures that led up to the crash and the way things were handled in the aftermath. Neither has made a full apology before this. Virginia Brooks told Lisa Owen on Thursday's checkpoint to be there to hear both Air New Zealand and the Prime Minister say sorry was just amazing.
They were enormous. To be honest, it's lifted a weight. I think because, you know, my dad was part of the air crew. He was on deck at the time, flight engineer Gordon Brooks. And, you know, I know my dad. I knew the men he flew with. You know what, they were good at their job. They knew what they were doing. They really loved to fly. But at the same time, when you hear it said that their negligence or their lack of attention to detail has caused this accident, you know what, I was 14 at the time, 15, and it stuck. I worried. I thought, my God, you know, my dad caused the death of all these people. Because I was a teenager. I'm trying to struggle to understand it. And, you know, and I knew that they wouldn't have knowingly done that because I knew how good they were I knew how good they were at what they could do. I knew how much flying meant to them. And, of course, you know, when you hear about the whiteout, the wrong coordinates, you know, there is no
residents
doubt they were not
at fault. Residents of Street have described hearing multiple gunshots
today
as armed officers
really
moved in on a man holding two young children hostage.
So that weight on your back, it sounds
no
almost like guilt, was it?
Fears grew for the children's safety.
I don't know if guilt's the word,
the man was killed about 14 hours
really
after police were first
called
to the house.
I knew deep down that there's no way that they had contributed to the accident because I knew how conscientious they were, I knew how good they were at their job. I know how much they love to fly. I mean, these are old school.
One of the children's throat. They retreated, taking one child but leaving
anything.
The man with the other
they could
two.
Fly blind
Bay
through
Plenty
whatever,
Superintendent Andy
you know,
McGregor told media
case,
last night
they
moved on the
by
house
the coordinates,
at about 3
night,
in the afternoon.
Coordinates. They were misled by a whiteout, and I think Air New Zealand has to bear some responsibility for not training their crews how to fly in those conditions. So, you know, so I don't know if guilt's the word, but... I
you
think
just
it's
had
that 14 or 15-year-old me that still thought, oh, my God, my dad has something to do with this. That, I just, you know, that still sits there in the back of my mind, I guess. So hearing this today, I think I'm still processing it. It's huge, actually.
So that burden that you carried as a young teenager, I mean, what effect do you think that's had on you over the years?
Oh, I think... it caused a lot of shame for a long time. You know, I just didn't tell people who my dad was. I didn't talk about the accident for years after it, probably for quite a few years to people. I didn't tell friends. I didn't tell people because I just didn't want to go there. And I was still trying to figure out what the hell had happened because there was all the controversy over what had caused the accident. And, you know, I was trying to piece together the pieces for myself. So I just didn't talk to people for a long time about it.
So
which isn't great when you're trying to get over grief and people don't understand that you're actually grieving.
So also today, the chair of Air New Zealand apologised
too. How courageous. How courageous. Huge. Thank you for that. I think it's very meaningful. I never thought I'd hear that, to be honest.
Why not?
Because it's a controversy that's raged on and raged on so deep for so long that, and there's so much politics behind the scenes, I just figured that ship had sailed, putting it bluntly. And I'm so glad that we've had this apology. It's meaningful. And, you know, I'm here today and the other relatives, and I'm seeing the impact of it for other people and what it means. And that's huge.
So in that room, when these two women issue this apology, give us a feeling for what it was like.
It's a very formal occasion, so I waited to, you know, they said it, and I waited for a minute to see if people were going to, you could hear some tears, you could hear some gasps and tears, but no one started clapping or cheering or anything like that because it wasn't that type of occasion. It was kind of, I think a bit of a stunned silence as well, and nobody was expecting that, or certainly I wasn't. I don't know if others were, but I wasn't. So it was quite gobsmacking.
It must be pretty bittersweet 40 years on.
And I think, yes, good word for it. Yeah.
So your father, Gordon, he was a flight engineer, you were about, 14, 15 at the time, you say?
14.
Yeah, so his voice was heard on the flight recording, yes?
Yes.
Tell us about that.
I've never heard it. I've never actually heard the flight recording, but in the transcript, I think it shows Dad's dedication to his job that he could be counting down the altitude while that plane, you know, in those final moments, because they wouldn't have understood. They didn't know that they were about to hit a mountain. And you just hear their procedural, on that black box, you hear them going through procedure. You know, they're hearing the whoop, whoop, pull up, pretty loud when you're in the cabin. And they would have, because they were good at what they did, they're reacting to procedure, and that's what you hear on the black box in those last moments.
Your dad doing his job right till the end.
Yeah, right till the end. And probably thinking, what the hell? Because their eyes are telling them one thing and their instruments are telling them something else. They would have been thoroughly confused, I think, in that moment as to what the heck was going on. And whether they ever got a chance to comprehend. I mean, they died so quickly. So whether they ever got a chance to comprehend, probably not.
Does today change anything for you?
Yeah, that I can feel that tangible lifting of a bit of weight, and it's just amazing, actually.
Virginia Brooks, whose father, Gordon Brooks, was the flight engineer on Flight 901 that crashed on Mount Erebus 40 years ago, speaking on Checkpoint. Residents of a Tauranga street have described hearing multiple gunshots as armed officers moved in on a man holding two young children hostage. The police say they had no other option as fears grew for the children's safety. The man was killed about 14 hours after police were first called at about 12:30 on Sunday morning. He had threatened his partner with a knife, and when officers arrived, they found him holding a machete to one of the children's throat. They retreated, taking one child but leaving the man with the other two. Bay of Plenty Commander Superintendent Andy McGregor told media on Sunday night they moved on the house at about 3 in the afternoon.
We received medical advice that there were grave concerns for the safety of the children due to dehydration, lack of food, their very young age, and the fact of where they were being held on the first floor of the building was extremely hot and stifling. On entry at the address, the offender had a knife at one of the child's chest. He was then shot. He died shortly after. The children that were still at the address were managed to be evacuated safely.
Superintendent McGregor said the police had to act.
We had no other option. And if you think of the situation where an offender's got a knife to the chest of a child and he's been behaving irrationally right throughout the day, he's already threatened a woman that had to leave the house with a knife. It's sad, but there's no other option. We had to get those kids out of that house safely.
On Monday's morning report, Andrew McRae reported neighbours had little idea that the lives of a 4-year-old and a 6-year-old were at risk.
16B Oriana Crescent is a small two-storey house down on a back section. It's cordoned off with a single orange police tape across the drive. The Crescent's a cul-de-sac in the suburb of Bellevue. One local, Marsh, lives about 100 metres from the house. The first he knew something was happening came at first light, waking to find the street full of police.
I saw all the cops sitting out here, all the defender squad and everything. Yeah, I didn't even realise they were here last night.
What happened after that one, once daybreak?
I disappeared for 5 hours, couldn't get back into my street, and then about 3 o'clock, yeah, it all turned to shit.
Andrew and his wife Katie woken up in the early hours after hearing police officers talking on the grass in front of their property. A friend who was staying had been out and was grabbed by the police as she returned to their home.
She was out partying and came back at about midnight, 1 o'clock, and got covered by cops in her cab and just asked, what are you doing? Where do you live? Where do you live? Rah, rah, rah. And she was just freaking out. Just said, I live at number 10, not number 16. So.
Andrew and Katie say events just slowly unfolded.
Yeah, it was just kind of building, and there was a lot of people just in the morning, I guess, and during the day. Today everyone was asking a lot of questions. We didn't really know what was going on, and the cops weren't really giving us much information. But they did just say that if you did leave, you might not be able to come back.
It wasn't bustling action. There were just cop cars all the way. And then there were two big armed defender traps here and just lots of police. But there wasn't like mayhem or anything.
Yeah, and I think the main thing that was going on was just various meetings with the armed defender squad and guys bringing in supplies of water and Subway. Whatever else for the guys that were hanging around a bit. So, yeah, there wasn't much. The road was just cornered off, and, yeah, there's just a lot of cops and no one really leaving the house.
Coralie returned home from work at about midday. She wasn't allowed into the street, but got home by walking through a neighbour's property. She was on her deck watching when police moved in to end the hostage drama.
Saw a lot of movements going backwards and forwards with the armed defenders. And we heard from those neighbours that it was a hostage situation, but I didn't want to tell anybody because I didn't know my facts. And when we were sitting there and it all happened, yeah, we heard the gunfire and it just all happened pretty quickly.
Marsh describes the last few minutes.
All I saw was an ambulance pulled up, gunfire, kids were pulled out, taken away, happy as, that was good, and just boom, 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 boom. It was good, good result.
So it's over pretty quickly once...
It dragged on all day and it was just over just like that.
Coralie says it was surreal just watching, but when the end came, it was pretty obvious what had happened.
And you knew it was gunfire, it was pretty obvious.
Yes, oh, it was so obvious, you couldn't mistake it, yeah.
How many police, armed police were there, do you think?
10, 12.
Dogs as well?
I saw a couple of dogs, but not many.
So what happened after the shooting? You heard the shots.
Yeah.
What happened then?
They sectioned off the driveway with two big trucks and saw an ambulance come take some kids away and sectioned off the driveway and then just, cleared up pretty quickly.
None of the neighbours I spoke to knew the man shot or the family involved.
I saw the guy a couple of times. He just sat there and glared at me the whole time from his finger head. Yeah, he wasn't right. But the kid's harmless as. I think my kids even played with one of their kids, you know.
Did you know the family, know the guy?
Nah, I didn't. Possibly a little bit of a recluse, but apparently stood at the top of the driveway every now and again, surveying the street. But yeah, I've never met the guy or didn't know him.
The house remains cordoned off under guard, and a scene search will be carried out today.
Andrew McRae with that report from Morning Report. A former Australian detective has ridiculed the National Party's zero-tolerance approach to gangs, saying the strategy has been a disaster across the ditch. The opposition is pitching a police unit based on New South Wales's Strike Force Raptor team. But a former Australian cop and now academic says it's actually driven the gangs underground there. Here's our deputy political editor Craig McCullough from Checkpoint.
The name guaranteed it would hit the headlines. Strike Force Raptor, an opposition proposal borrowed from abroad. An elite police squad modelled on one like it in New South Wales, designed to punish gang members through all legal avenues, coming after them for any infraction, from parking fine to punch-up.
It has been hugely successful. It's been devastatingly effective. It has been devastatingly effective.
But on RNZ this morning, Simon Bridges struggled to point to hard evidence backing that up.
We are at this moment, in fact, talking to the government in New South Wales to compile the data.
The data has not yet been forthcoming. RNZ has also had difficulty tracking down the stats. Requests to the New South Wales Police were at first rebuffed and then not answered.
We will put out some data in the next little while to make clear the case. But what is also true is if you just Google Strike Force Raptor units and you look at the stories and the commentary,
you'll see, he says, it's been a success. It's true that a Google search does bring up some effusive accounts, like this Nine News report, which Mr Bridges has shared on Twitter.
Strike Force Raptor has made life hell for outlaw bikie gangs and is responsible for more than 5,000 arrests in the past decade. They've also laid more than 12,000 charges, seized 1,700 illegal firearms and shut down more than 50 clubhouses.
But that's not all that Google uncovers. It also finds articles alleging stalking and intimidation by the police unit. It finds serious misconduct. A team member known as Raptor 13, who was recently put on restricted duties for threatening two Muslim women. And it finds videos of aggressive and confrontational encounters with members of the public.
It's just been a disaster.
Mike Kennedy is a former detective from the New South Wales Police Force. He spent much of his service as an undercover cop working in organised crime and is now a senior lecturer at the University of Western Sydney.
There's no local, there's no national and there's no international evidence that zero tolerance as a principal operational strategy is successful or that it works.
Dr Kennedy says it's nonsense to suggest gang numbers in New South Wales have dramatically dropped over the past decade.
How would you know? They're not required to pay a fee to be a member of the gang and register with government.
And as for Mr Bridges' references to reports that the bikies have been driven near extinction...
He needs to pull his head out of whatever it's stuck in, because it simply isn't the case. People don't stop being members of groups just because they've been arrested. They go into jail, they reinforce themselves, they come out, they get more of a reason to remain in the group they're in. I just think he's living a dream if he's thinking that, you know, and I'm not a bleeding heart liberal.
Dr Kennedy says groups like Strike Force Raptor ultimately turn the public against the police. People view the authorities as unreasonable and refuse to cooperate with other investigations.
If the public doesn't trust you and if the organised crime community doesn't trust you to do your job, you haven't succeeded. All you've done is driven the problem underground, which is what no one wants.
The proposal is not yet official National Party policy. The opposition is still sounding out the idea with the public. But historically, such tough-on-crime rhetoric has been popular with voters. To that, Dr. Kennedy sounds a final cautionary note.
Might get him into office. The problem is it's also going to get him out of office in the long term.
That report from our deputy political editor, Craig McCulloch, as heard on Wednesday's Checkpoint. Earlier that morning on Morning Report, the National leader, Simon Bridges, was defending the party's gang proposals.
Is that your goal here, to harass gang members so much that they somehow miraculously stop being gang members?
Yes, every single day. And you say miraculously, but look, having gone through what's happened in New South Wales with Strike Force Raptor Unit, it has been remarkably successful. Indeed, I was just reading in the last few days in the media there, they're talking about the making of gangs extinct. Now, the extent that the lawyer was saying, and I didn't hear it all, but, you know, the letter of the law is not being followed. I don't go along with that at all. The letter of the law should be followed.
So what's the evidence you're referring to? Because I've been struggling to find any evidence that there are still bikie gangs operating in Australia, and the argument is that you're right in the sense that they may not have their clubhouses, but there's still criminal gang activity in New South Wales.
Oh, of course, and I think, you know, we're never going to have nirvana, a situation where there isn't some of that. But can you reduce it? Can you make sure that you're not having intimidation on your streets at the level that I think we are seeing in New Zealand? I believe you can. And I think we do have to talk just a little about the problem definition. You've got a situation here where gangs have gone up 26% in the last 2 years. There are 1,400 more.
Yes, and we know, one of the arguments is that that is because Australia has been exporting its gang members, former New Zealanders, back to New Zealand, and that is a significant reason for any reduction in their gang rate.
I think that is part of the reason. Actually, if you go to Minister Stuart Nash, the numbers he's provided us with, if they are to be believed, it's a very small part of the problem. Now, I tend to go along with you. It must be a part of it. What is also true, and what police are telling my colleagues and I, is that whereas in the past, becoming a fully initiated PAPS gang member might take 2 years, now you're talking more like 6 months. And the reason for that is their desire for dominance, the level of competition amongst gangs, and the money they are making.
Are you going to consider the anti-consorting laws whereby somebody who hasn't committed any offence could be charged with an offence if they associate with two or more gang members?
I think in the discussion document they are raising that issue. I mean, I think it's the sort of thing that it is worth asking the question on. I'm not committed to doing that, and I can appreciate legitimate legal concerns, concerns around the rule of law that they would be around doing those sort of
things. Well, you'll be familiar with the evidence then of the Australian Ombudsman that looked at this issue and found that that it is hitting vulnerable groups, including Aboriginal people, children and homeless, and it raised questions as to whether there was a very high police error rate. And I just wonder, if you're going to spend millions and millions of dollars harassing gangs, is this really going to work and achieve anything?
I think it will. I mean, as I say, I think we've got confidence levels that it has in New South Wales. I think the...
Can you just point me to the evidence that shows it has actually reduced gang activity there? Because I couldn't find any.
We are at this moment, in fact, talking to the government in New South Wales to compile the data. I don't want to give you numbers right now.
But it's very important. Is there any actual written evidence you're referring to here?
We will put out some data in the next little while to make clear the case. But what is also true is if you just Google Strike Force Raptor units and you look at the stories and the commentary about how it is perceived in New South Wales, it is seen as remarkable.
Yeah, but that's a difference between lots of raids and lots of headlines and actually achieving anything. And the argument is that yes, you can harass these gangs. It is simply going to mean that they filter off elsewhere from those clubhouses and continue doing what they're doing.
Well, you know, I think it's two sides of a coin. I think the tough on crime approach is right. I think if you don't do that, you breed more criminals. I think the other side of it, though, social investment, rehabilitation, reintegration, making sure you are doing all you can across your social sector to prevent crime in the first place is incredibly important as well.
Okay, I'll get to that very shortly. Just one more question issue on the gangs. what's the issues here around human rights? Do you have concerns that this law or these proposed moves would breach the New Zealand Bill of Rights, and does that bother you?
Well, I think ultimately it comes back to what I've already said, which is, are we serious about this or not? Well, we've got an inexorable rise in gang membership at the moment. I think if we continue with Jacinda Ardern's approach, we just see it continuing to rise.
So does that mean you would be prepared to pass legislation in breach of the New Zealand Bill of Rights, freedom of association, freedom of expression, in order to carry out what you want to do?
Ultimately, if the goals and the purposes on the other side of that, in terms of reducing crime, seeing fewer gang members, peddling pee, peddling misery is the result,
that
would be a goal and a purpose worth having.
So what's the point in having a Bill of Rights?
It's very important. It's something that is there as a law that allows people to see and to measure and weigh these things.
Some might argue, Mr. Bridges, it's there to also ensure that politicians can't override fundamental basic human rights.
Well, if we sent someone to prison for the first time today, that would be a breach of fundamental human rights. But of course we do it, because ultimately these things are proportionate and we are weighing these things every day. Where you've got gangs that are peddling pee, that are growing, that are peddling misery, that are making crime worse in New Zealand, that causes endless misery and harm.
Yes, but we have a system that currently deals with that. The police, from it's not hard to see that the police are raiding gang pads and are dealing with the criminal issues.
I'm sorry, they are losing the war. Right at the moment, we have nearly double the amount of new gang members to new police officers coming out of our police colleges. We have a situation where they've got their hooks into middle New Zealand and Napier and Tauranga and Southland, actually in Auckland where I am right now. I mean, I defy someone to sit there for a week, go out and about and tell me they haven't seen a patch gang member. The only reason with those patches is intimidation. And so I say, are we serious or not? Look, if we're not serious, okay. We can amble on the way we are. If we are serious, I think we need to think about things such as the unit I've talked about, banning gang patches.
And the Bill of Rights, and breaching the Bill of Rights. So does that mean that Paula Bennett was right when she said that gang members have less human rights, fewer human rights, different human rights than others?
Ultimately, parliaments pass laws in the interests of all New Zealanders. And that's what I would do if I'm government. But I don't shy away from what I've said yesterday.
Well, hang on, no, I need you to answer that question, because this is very important, Mr. Bridges.
I think I've answered it very, very directly, actually.
So she's right. They have
disrupt and harass gangs as Prime Minister every single day, because they are an unalloyed social evil, and we don't want...
Sure, and that's fine. And look, I know a number of people will support your view, but I just want to get it clear, as the leader of the opposition, Mr. Bridges, the leader of the opposition, a potential future Prime Minister, you are saying that gang members do not have the same human rights as other people.
I am saying to you the letter of the law will be followed, that every person in New Zealand has the right to a lawyer and the right to defend themselves fully and within the full arsenal of the law. But of course, all laws have to be weighed. And in laws such as this in the criminal arena, we are constantly weighing both the rights implications and the effect of those laws. And in terms of Strike Force Raptor, in terms of banning gang patches, you know, I take the view, actually, that if we're serious about doing away with gangs, that is a more important value and gets more weighting than the other.
So just to ask you again, do gang members have the same rights as other, same human rights as other New Zealanders?
Of course they do.
On the issue of rehabilitation, you acknowledged yesterday in your comments that your policies could lead to a higher prison muster, that there would be longer sentences, issues around parole. Does that mean that we'll be building more prisons?
Well, ultimately, if it's a call again between more victims of crime in our communities or slightly more prisoners, I'd take slightly more prisoners. I think, you know, what we do to rehabilitate and reintegrate is vitally important. They don't come back for a second and a third time. I mean, that's why, for example, and I appreciate, you know, someone like Kim Workman poo-poos it and says, you know, it's a breach of human rights. I think we should put every prisoner that can into work while in prisons. It's good for them and it sets them up for success on the outside. I also think, look, in terms of the youth court and youth crimes, we should be giving people a second chance. We should be ensuring, look, they're not defined by one stupid incident. So it is both things, I think, that are true. Being tough on crime, in my view, works, but we also need that wider piece. And I would urge people, if they read the Law and Order discussion documents, to read our welfare and education documents as well, because I think they present then the complete picture of how we make change in New Zealand.
Okay. Are not some of these policies, though, going against the expert advice here that we need to be focusing even more on rehabilitation, that locking people up for longer, building more prisons, simply doesn't work? In fact, your own former leader, Bill English, is famous, of course, for saying that it's a fiscal failure, prisons. You are going against the tide of critical opinion, aren't you?
No, I don't believe so. I think, you know, my point is that it is both. If you're just tough on crime, you lack compassion and proportion. If, though, you take the other view and you don't do any of that, you breed more criminals. I want to do both. I think the reality of criminology, and I've studied it both at my first degree and at a postgraduate level, is people have different views on this. I take the view on the evidence that is there that deterrence does work, both in terms of certainty of being convicted and in severity.
Just finally on that,
in the wider community.
Take your point, you can do both, but don't you undercut your argument on rehabilitation by taking what some argue is a very populist, extreme position on gangs that won't work?
You know what the funny thing is on that, Corin? Populist doesn't mean it's wrong. I fervently believe the things I am saying to you. John Campbell just cited to me a speech I gave in 2009. Well, I had precisely the same views then that I do today, because I think it is what works. By the way, things that aren't popular doesn't necessarily mean they are right. I think we're on the right track here.
National leader Simon Bridges with Corin Dann on Morning Report. The police have warned one person and two others are under investigation for naming Grace Mullane's killer on social media during his High Court trial. Last Friday, the 27-year-old was found guilty of murdering the British backpacker after a Tinder date last December. The man's name and any details that may identify him remain suppressed by the court. But people have continued to ignore the court order as well as warnings from police by naming the killer online. Katie Scotcher filed this for Monday's Checkpoint program.
Grace Mullane's final hours were carefully examined at her killer's High Court trial, and a large media contingent reported on almost every detail. But one of the simplest details, her killer's name, was left out of coverage.
Do you find the defendant guilty or not guilty?
Guilty. That bleeped out name was and remains suppressed by the court. But that hasn't stopped some international news sites and members of the public naming him online. This has been an ongoing problem since his arrest last December. At the man's first court appearance, someone in the public gallery snapped a picture of him and posted it online, while others repeatedly shared his name on social media. The breach has prompted warnings from lawyers, judges and the police. By May of this year, 6 months after her murder, one person had been warned and police inquiries into other incidents were ongoing. His three-week High Court trial this month provoked another surge of people to again breach the suppression order on social media. Justice Minister Andrew Little expects New Zealanders who share the name on social media will face legal action.
I understand authorities will be looking at situations where that has happened in the last couple of days. Contempt of court is a serious matter. Courts take it seriously when those cases are brought before them, but ultimately that's a matter for the police and the Crown Law Office.
Over the weekend, police said they were aware Ms. Mullane's killer had been named on social media in New Zealand and reminded the public that breaching court-ordered suppressions is an offence. Anyone who breaks the law in New Zealand could face a fine of up to $25,000 or 6 months in jail. The police now say they have warned one person and are still investigating two others for naming the man online during the trial. They say anyone who posts his name online risks being charged. But criminal barrister Todd Simmons says charges for breaching suppression orders are really laid.
I think historically that really reflects the fact that court orders are treated seriously and they are certainly complied with as they should be.
And Mr. Simmons says those who point others in the direction of his name online aren't likely to be charged either.
In general terms, it would require publication of name, address, occupation or other information that would likely reveal the identity of the subject matter.
The 27-year-old will be sentenced for Grace Mullane's murder early next year.
Katie Scotcher with that report from Checkpoint. You're listening to The Week in Review. Still to come, academics and the vaping industry say the government urgently needs to bring in e-cigarette regulations. And Auckland Council is sending enforcement officers to catch any law flouters who use closed tracks and risk spreading the deadly Kauri dieback disease.
Depending on which rules you break, we'll use whatever tool we think is appropriate.
Still to come in The Week in Review. A jogger repeatedly smashed in the head by a serial attacker preying on lone women says she felt pure terror as the man silently punched her over and over. The woman was out for a late afternoon run on a walkway on Auckland's North Shore on November 8th when the man jumped her from behind and threw her to the ground. So far, police believe four similar attacks are linked. Three were on or near the Murray's Bay track and a fourth at a park in Massey. All have been in daylight hours with the women walking or jogging on their own. Two women have suffered serious injuries, including a broken collarbone, broken nose, dislocated shoulder and concussion. On Tuesday's Checkpoint program, Lisa Owen spoke with one of the women who was attacked. She told her how that afternoon started out.
So I was approaching the walkway. So at the bottom of the stairs, we walked past each other, like shoulder to shoulder, and looked each other in the eye. And he didn't smile, but, you know, some people don't. So I just thought nothing of it and I ran up the first set of stairs and carried on.
Did he speak to you at that point at all?
No, nothing at all. Just looked me right in the eyes and then kept walking.
And what do you remember about him from that moment?
I remember that he was wearing a hat with a sticker on the peak. And he looks like nice and clean and tidy. Like, I would never have thought anything of him. Like, he didn't look scary at all. And, yeah, he just looked like a normal guy.
And so was he kind of wearing sportswear, like he was out for a walk? Or can you tell us anything about what he was wearing?
No, I don't. He didn't look like he was out for a walk. I imagined that he was, like, going to meet some friends down at one of the pubs in Browns Bay. He just looks, like, nice and clean and tidy with a hat and, I think, a black T-shirt on and just looked normal.
So you carried on up the stairs, and what happened next?
Yes, I ran up the first set, and then I walked up the second two smaller sets, and I was just walking along the flat with my headphones on, no idea what was behind me, and the next thing I knew, I think he'd thrown me on the ground, and then I was just, like, in a ball on the ground, and he punched me in the head, I think, four times, and then he just ran away.
So when he came up behind you, what could you feel? Where did he put his arms around you and how did he throw you down?
Well, I don't really know because it was so quick. All I can remember is that I was walking and then the next thing I knew, I was in a ball on the ground being punched. So I don't know how he got me there. It was all so quick.
And did you hit your head or your shoulders when you landed on the ground?
Yeah, I must have taken like the full force to my shoulder, I think, because that's what's injured now. And then my head is a bit injured, I think, from the punches, though.
Okay, so you're on the ground, and then what? You become aware of him still hitting you?
Yeah, so I knew I had to, like, protect myself, so I had both my arms over my head, which was why I think he couldn't get to my face. So he just kept punching me in the side of the head, and I was just thinking, like, is he going to stop? It was just, like, pure terror. And then I was just so grateful when he ran away, like I just knew it was over.
So when you're lying there and he punched you in the side of the head, he kept going, yes?
Yeah.
And then what happened? He just disappeared?
Yeah, he picked something up, which I thought was my headphones, but I think they were found in the bush. So I think he just picked his hat up and then he just ran away. And I didn't even turn to check if he was gone. I just knew in my head that he was gone and I needed to get out and get help.
While he was attacking you, did he say anything?
I don't think he spoke at all, from what I can remember. I don't think he did.
And what was going through your head at this time? Because it must have been terrifying.
Yeah, luckily it was so quick, so you don't have a lot of time to think. But I think I was just, yelling sorry or stop, like, because I thought he was so angry that obviously I'd done something that annoyed him. But it was more just like I just wanted him to stop. So I was just relieved the second that he did.
And he just abruptly stopped?
Yeah, he just literally punched his foot four times, picked up his hat and ran full speed.
And did you see which direction he headed off in?
I didn't even look. I know he ran towards Beechwood, but I didn't see if he turned left or right. I didn't even, like, turn around to check he was gone. Somehow I just knew he was.
And then, so what did you do after he took off?
So I got to my feet and got my phone out of my armband and rang my partner and said, like, I need help quick. And then I stood there and yelled help for a bit, but realised no one would hear me in the walkway. So I managed to walk to the road where I found a girl that helped me call an ambulance.
And then some other passerbys, I understand, wandered by as well.
Yeah, two ladies appeared pretty quickly, and I think the German girl passed the phone to them so that they could speak to the ambulance, and she just sat with me and gave me water and, like, comforted me.
You must have been in complete shock.
Yeah, at that point I could, like, barely breathe, so that they were asking me all these questions, but I was just trying to catch my breath, and I was in agony, so I just was sort of a blur.
Yeah, tell me about your injuries.
So the worst is my shoulder, so that's I have, like, a dislocated AC joint. So that's pretty bad. And then my elbow's all bruised and sore, which I think I must have landed on as well. I've had vertigo for the last week, which I think is obviously from being hit in the head. And I've just had cuts and bruises on my ankle and knee and fist and everywhere.
So those are the physical injuries, but what about you? How are you doing?
I think I'm doing really well considering, like, that's the best I could be. I'm feeling a lot more comfortable, like, being alone again. At first I was a lot more worried, but I think I'm doing as best as I can.
So do you feel safe to go out and about again? Like, would you go out jogging or walking again on your own?
Yeah, I definitely would, but I won't go down any walkways or any quiet areas, only main roads.
So have you had to take some time off work to recuperate?
Yeah, so I've already had, I think this is my third week off work. I'm hoping that I'll be able to go back to work maybe part-time next week, but I'll just have to see how I go.
Yeah. So what are the police saying to you about this?
They've been so helpful. I've met so many different police already, like, all coming to do different things. They've been amazing, like, just keeping me informed, and they've still got, like, a whole team working on it, so they've been really helpful.
So I'm wondering, you've probably thought about this a lot. Have you thought about what this guy was up to or what his motivations were and all that kind of stuff? What's going through your head?
Yeah, I guess it's just crazy. Like, you think, what is he getting out of it? Like, all he's doing is hurting women and then running away. Like, it's not like he wants anything more. Like, it just doesn't make any sense. I just think he must have something, like, really wrong going on in his head.
So what would you say to people out there who may recognise this man and the CCTV footage that the police have put out? What would you say to anyone who has any clues to who he is?
Just to please ring the police or the number that's on, like, all the ads and stuff, because he's not going to stop. And I think there's been four of us now, and he could be getting worse each time. And you don't know, like, when he's throwing people on the ground, is he going to injure someone, like, and hit them in their head, and he needs to be stopped, so somebody has to call if they know anything.
Would you want to say anything to him if he was listening?
I guess just that people don't deserve this, and he's ruining people's lives, and he just needs to get help.
And mid-afternoon Friday, police announced they had arrested a teenager after the spate of violent attacks on walking tracks in Auckland. The police say the 17-year-old male was arrested on Friday and will appear in the youth court on Saturday. He's charged with wounding with intent to cause grievous bodily harm, assault with intent to commit sexual violation, and aggravated assault. Between August and November, the police say there were 5 attacks, 3 on the North Shore and 2 in West Auckland. Detective Senior Sergeant Callum McNeil says their investigation continues and further charges are possible. 2 former Prime Ministers are backing calls to move Auckland's used carport to Whangarei. Both Sir John Key and Helen Clark have publicly backed the Waterfront 2029 campaign and are hoping to raise $250,000 to get it started. While neither the current government nor the National Party have picked a side at this point, New Zealand First has long campaigned for the shift. A spokesperson for the Waterfront 2029 campaign, Michael Goldwater, said Auckland had a once-in-a-generation opportunity to unlock the values of its waterfront for its people and ratepayers.
The reality is we're sitting on New Zealand's best land, the most expensive land in New Zealand. It has much better use than for an industrial port. Obviously, ports are really important, but the port's in the wrong place. 100 years ago, it was a good place for a port. Now it's not. It's constrained on all sides.
And now 2 former Prime Ministers, Helen Clark and Sir John Key, have backed the plan. Corin Dan spoke to Sir John Key on Monday's Morning Report.
Oh, look, I just think it's an idea that time has come and the reality has risen an inflection point for Auckland. You either spend, you know, many, many billion dollars now, I think, maintaining the port in Auckland, or you make the bold decision to move it. And, you know, I think if you sat there and said, if you had a clean sheet of paper, would you build a port in the way that it functions currently in Auckland? The answer is no. Now, everyone can see that it's, you know, whatever number you want to choose, it'll all be wrong, but let's say it's $10 billion to move it. That's true, but it's probably, you know, $7 or $8 billion to maintain it. And so if you make that call, then there are lots of options available about what happens next.
You mentioned that there's been a number of reports. There seems to have been 5 or 6 reports done into this. I'm wondering whether some done during your time in government. How are we supposed to make sense of whether this is actually financially feasible, given the wide range of reports?
Yeah, well, I think you'll never have a perfect answer. Certainly a bit of work was done. Stephen Joyce, I remember, had a bit of a look at it at one point and, you know, was concerned about the costs involved. But I mean, probably what's happened, frankly, over, you know, a period of time is that land down at the waterfront's become a lot more valuable. Now, you know, let's just assume for a moment that you were to move the port, and there'd be a combination, I think, of both Tauranga and up north at Northport. Then, you know, goodness knows what Auckland gets for that land over the next 10, 15-year period. But you can see what's happened down at the Wynyard Quarter there, where you've got the tank farm. I mean, it's a huge sum of money there. Now, Auckland ultimately could use that money to both reduce its balance sheet borrowings, because it's got a lot of debt on its balance sheet, and ultimately use that money for other initiatives it wants. Secondly, there's a lot of cross-ownership already. Tauranga own a chunk of Northport. Auckland owns a bit of Northport via another vehicle. So, I mean, ultimately, it doesn't mean that Auckland has to give up its dividend flow. You know, it's only getting about $8.5-9 million dividend against a, you know, goodness knows what the investment's worth, but, you know, say many, many billions. So the point is, you could do that, and you could still have a structure probably where, you know, it's a public-private partnership of some sort, some floated and some owned by the 3 existing ports. So there's a vehicle there that works, I think.
Of course, Stephen Joyce, have you spoken to him about it? Because he is still dead against it. A number of the points he raises is the issue of the rail coming back from Northport. Not only the fact that you're moving distance from port to your main city, but also getting through Auckland. And some of those issues he raises would be insurmountable.
Yeah, okay, so there's obviously a fair bit of work to do, but an important point to remember at the moment is about 30% of Auckland's imports come through the inland port, which they come into Tauranga and are shipped via rail into the inland port. So we already do a lot of that already. You'd clearly have to have another inland port north of Auckland. So there's no question, yes, there's a substantial rail upgrade, and I think road upgrade. I think you ultimately need to take the road 4 lanes all the way through to Whangarei. But they are, in my opinion, a positive byproduct you get from undertaking this venture, because all of a sudden you get a better roading infrastructure. You certainly get a much better rail infrastructure. And at the moment, we've got hundreds of trucks being dragged up and down Ngāpiti Road in Auckland, clogging up, you know, what is your major city. And And then you get, you know, putting all those benefits to one side and also what you might actually do down at Auckland's waterfront, you all of a sudden, instead of locking the waterfront away with, you know, big red fences and the likes, you actually open it up to what would be, you know, magnificent mixed-use development and something akin to what Sydney's got. And I think if you just took a sort of 50-year view of where Auckland's going, there's absolutely no doubt in my mind the city's going to continue to grow, continue to prosper, dramatically change, and a critical part of that is a beautiful waterfront which is fully used to the potential we know it has.
Former Prime Minister Sir John Key speaking on Morning Report. Academics and the vaping industry say the government urgently needs to bring in e-cigarette regulations. Their demands come at the same time as more than 60 health, community and school organisations have written an open letter saying young people need to be better protected. The government says the process is taking longer than it would like, but it has to get it right. Jill Bonnet filed this for Wednesday's Morning Report.
A researcher at the Auckland Bioengineering Institute, Dr. Kelly Burrows, says there's mounting evidence that e-cigarettes present considerable risks. She says regulations are needed now.
Really urgent, I think. At the moment, there's no way of knowing what chemicals are within the e-liquids, and I think these products have become so widespread in the community. You know, there's a vape shop on every corner almost, so I think it's really vital that this moves forward very quickly.
Dr. Burrows says it will be at least another 10 years before it becomes clear what the health risks are. She says common smoking-related diseases such as lung cancer and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease only occur in older adults, and younger people may be unaware of the risks.
I don't really have a feel for whether people realise that they are potentially dangerous. So we've found more than 50 chemicals in the aerosols we've analysed. We've found heavy metals, including lead, small amounts of arsenic, and the problem is a lot of the flavourings added, while they're thought to be safe for ingestion, nobody knows the effect that they could have on the lungs.
An adjunct professor at Canterbury University, Dr. Murray Logeson, who published a New Zealand report on e-cigarette toxins in 2015, says vaping may be safer than combustible cigarettes. But he says without regulations, there's no mechanism for official testing of what's on the market, and that should be given more priority.
With every passing day, we don't know where we are. So time has dragged on, and we're still nowhere near getting legislation in place.
Policy options for regulation were first put out for submission by the Ministry of Health in 2016. Last spring, the Associate Minister of Health, Jenny Salazar, said legislation, including limiting vape product retail displays in a similar way to how cigarettes are sold, would be introduced this year. The Vaping Alliance says it had expected changes last November. Its president, QJ Satchell, says through vaping, New Zealand has the opportunity to become a world leader in smoking cessation.
We've been screaming out for regulation for a number of years. These products are, you know, they've been heavily tested from all angles, and we know hands down that conservatively they're 95% less harmful than a combustible cigarette.
QJ Satchell says Public Health England now calculates e-cigarettes are 98% safer than smoking. However, rather than wanting to keep operating with no rules, he's keen for the government to finalise how they want to regulate the burgeoning industry and give it more certainty.
My company, NZ Vapor, we've invested around $500,000 in a clean room and a factory, and we're doing all these sorts of things without even the knowledge of, are we even going to have a future? You know, that's a big investment. I sold my family home to get into this business.
He says because of how contentious the subject has become, the government may be tempted to release details of the bill just before Christmas. In a statement, Jenny Salazar says amending the Smoke-Free Environments Act to cover vaping and vape products is no small task, and it's taking time to work through the detail. She says the government wants a future-proof framework, ensuring vaping is available for smokers who wish to quit and that nicotine products aren't marketed or sold to children and young people.
Jill Bonnet with that report from Morning Report. A campaigner against winter grazing has been vindicated by a top-level investigation. Angus Robson led protests against the farming practice that keeps cattle in muddy, confined paddocks. He was invited to be part of the Agriculture Minister's task force. The report says there have to be changes, such as making sure cows can lie on dry ground, have access to shelter and continuous clean water and a balanced diet. Angus Robson joined Susie Ferguson on Tuesday's Morning Report.
Are you happy with the report?
Yes, I am. Yep.
What do you think are the best aspects of it?
The two main things are recognition of the problem, that there actually is a problem that's serious and it needs dealing with, which up to really the start of the task force, I don't think was the case. And secondly, how hard and well everybody worked at the task force. There were a lot of diverse views, people from all the sectors, and there was naturally a fair bit of tension between all of the people at the task force for the different outcomes, you know, from me and the SPCA and the beef and lamb and dairy, you know, different options, all to get a good outcome but without harming their own industries. And I thought we worked exceptionally well together, smart people working hard for a good outcome. And we did get a good outcome.
So despite the fact that this was right across the sector, it wasn't sort of tetchy at any point?
I don't think I heard a single crossword between any of the participants.
Nonetheless, DairyNZ and Beef and Lamb, some of the farming groups here, they're saying some of the recommendations make sense, but other parts are unrealistic.
Some of it we would have to work towards. You know, there's some wording in there which is slightly aspirational about having certainly the dry areas for cows to lie down on. The cows simply don't like lying on the wet. But how soon we can move to a practical lying area which is suitable for cows, whether or not it's a little bit damp or not, it's not like we're saying it's okay for them to lie in deep mud over again, which has been the case in the past. And so it might take some time before we get to the outcomes we're after, but certainly we're heading in the right direction, I believe.
Why is that going to be such a tricky thing to do?
Well, we run an outside system, and there are several downsides to running cows indoors. They don't often like lying on wet concrete indoors either. It's very expensive to run an indoor system, and it's not always a very good animal welfare outcome there either. So what do we do that matches up with our good outdoor system, but that still provides a good loafing area? We need to work on, and I'm sure we'll get there.
Who or which part of the sector do you think needs to step up the most to make the biggest difference?
It's interesting. What we learned was just how deeply across the whole supply chain things were spread, starting with the seed merchants. You know, what pressure do the seed merchants put on to farmers to use certain types of crops? For example, fodder beet was the one that we saw that had the worst outcomes, you know, the deepest mud, the worst environmental runoff. It's a very difficult crop to grow. It's like a Formula One crop. And the seed merchants were recommending it to people who clearly didn't have the skills to manage a crop like that. And it destroys the soil for 5 years, and I'm quite certain that they weren't told that they'd be losing their soils. So, you know, that's a decision made right up front about how you do your advertising. And one of the task force recommendations is that you consider animal welfare in your advertising and in your promotions. And, you know, some seed merchants do that and others don't. And to have it out there to say we need to do this is a good thing. Then we move into, you know, how to plough, where to plough. There are minimal restrictions on that from regional councils, which we believe ought to be indicated. So don't go there or you'll have problems, because once you plant, in the dry weather, it looks fine, but then when it gets wet, it all goes terrible, and it's too late by then. It's too late to fix.
So should there be more people coming forward to report breaches if they see them, rather than just sort of assuming that this is a practice that, just goes on, it's just part of what happens?
Very much so. MPI is not well set up to receive the breaches, and that was another thing that the task force found. Was the laws, and this was mentioned by John Hellstrom yesterday, the laws around cows in mud are very uncertain. You know, there's no specific offence for having a cow in mud. You know, while on this topic, one of the things that I was astonished by was the practice vets who deal with intensive winter grazing. It seemed to me that they had the least solutions, that the least acknowledgement of a problem, And I think that's another story altogether.
Angus Robson, who led protests against the farming practice that keeps cattle in muddy, confined paddocks, and invited to be part of the Agriculture Minister's task force against it, speaking on Morning Report. Moidaki residents are angry at the increasing number of visitors scratching their names into the famous boulders. They're demanding better management of the popular tourism site. Katie Todd filed this for Tuesday's Morning Report.
They're the 6 to 7 tonne sapphires, loved by both Waitaki locals and about 70,000 visitors a year. But some people can't help leaving their mark on the Moidaki boulders. Leslie Campbell, who's lived in the coastal town for 30 years, says the problems ramped up over the past 6 months. On a recent trip to the beach, she says almost every boulder had been defaced, with names and random graffiti chipped into the rock.
I think it's really disrespectful to the boulders. It's disrespectful to the people who live in the area, and it's disrespectful for people who come to visit.
And she even caught one group of visitors in the act.
There was a boulder coming out from the cliff face, and people were about to have a go at it, and I just felt that it's inappropriate. And I think when they reflected on it, they probably realised it was inappropriate as well.
The sea has since washed some of the damage off the softer boulders, but Ms Campbell says she'd expect better protection for a site that's often advertised as the district's flagship tourist destination. The problem was also noticed and photographed by a recent visitor to Moidaki, Lauren Flutie, who says people seem to hone in on the soft, newly formed boulders, which are also surrounded with rubbish and cigarette butts. She says a few more signs and bins wouldn't go amiss in the scenic reserve, which is run by the Department of Conservation. And that's something DOC is happy to consider. Its Coastal Otago Operations Manager, Mike Hopkins, says the vandalism is disappointing, disrespectful and illegal.
With the boulders resting in the public beach, it's really challenging for us to monitor and protect those boulders. So we really do rely on the public to let us know if they've noticed any new damage. We'd like to meet with the Waitaki locals who have seen the vandalism. We'd like to discuss potential solutions around monitoring and trying to prevent any further damage.
The Chief Executive of the Waitaki District Council, Fergus Power, is also aware of the vandalism, although he says it's somewhat inevitable for a natural feature that gets a lot of visitors. He says the council will be working with DOC to help deter the taggers, including more publicity about the penalties of imprisonment up to 5 years or a $100,000 fine. The boulders are likely to attract even more attention as part of the Waitaki Whitestone Geopark, which might get UNESCO recognition as a top tourist destination. One of the trustees, Helen Jansen, says that will mean better informed, better educated visitors.
We're all about promoting sustainability and getting that message across about the significance of the district as a geological history. And there are panels being developed behind the scenes as we speak in order to better tell the story of many of the sites.
But Leslie Campbell has another way of looking at it.
If the area is going to pursue a geopark, then it needs to demonstrate that it can look after and protect the resources that it has. Somebody just needs to step up and take responsibility.
DOC's asking locals to take photos if they see boulders being vandalised and report them via its phone line, 0800 DOC HOT, or by visiting the Dunedin DOC office.
Katie Todd with that report from Morning Report. Auckland Council sending enforcement officers out to the Waitakere and Hunua ranges this summer to catch any law flouters who use closed tracks and risk spreading the deadly Kauri dieback disease. The council has laid charges against a man after he was caught 3 times on a closed track and have issued almost 50 trespass notices to others. Those protecting the track say it's locals who are their own worst enemy, feeling entitled to use the park. Again, here's our reporter, Jordan Bond.
3 things are asked of visitors to the Waitakere ranges. Only use open tracks, clean your shoes on the way in and out, and keep your dogs on a leash. But when I arrived at the Arataki Visitor Centre this morning, I spied 2 people dodging the shoe cleaning stations with their dog roaming free. They didn't want to talk to me when I approached them, and it seems they're not the only ones. A local walking guide, Jeff, pumped his fist when he heard someone's being taken to court for refusing to stay off closed tracks.
There's got to be some deterrent to say to people, you've got to realise that we are trying to prevent the spread of cowry dieback disease. They have to follow the rules. Life's full of rules. This is just one of them.
David Alexander moved here a year ago and heads to the ranges about once a week.
It seems like the most frustrated people are the people who've lived here all along and have sort of always used these tracks. I can understand a little bit if you, I guess, really feel like this is your home. It's probably hard to see part of it closed. It's one of those things where if you want other people to be able to enjoy it, I think you follow the rules and do the right thing.
The disease travels by soil. Once it gets into Cody roots, there's no cure and the trees slowly die. Cody are considered taonga, treasures, and they're a keystone species. About 17 other plants depend entirely on Cody. Auckland Council closes the tracks in the worst condition to minimise soil movement and is upgrading some with elevated boardwalks or laying more gravel. Its compliance manager, Steve Pearce, says most people respect the closures, but more serious deterrence is needed for some.
Depending on which rules you break, we'll use whatever tool we think is appropriate. So that can include a fine under Local Government Act. It can include trespass. It can also include infringement notices under different pieces of legislation like the Dog Control Act and the Biosecurity Act.
The Mayor, Phil Goff, says it's regrettable that the council has had to prosecute over the closures, but the man being taken to court was entitled about his access to the area. He faces a maximum penalty of $20,000 if convicted. Almost 40 tracks are open or partially open in the Waitakere Ranges. Dr. Mels Barton from the Tree Council says many of them are not in good condition and won't do well with the summer influx of walkers.
So the tracks that were not closed right at the start, they are in a terrible state. They're absolutely shocking. They're far worse than they were when Te Kawarau Āmaki said that they were suitable to be left open. And absolutely no work has been done on any of those tracks whatsoever in the last 2 years.
The council's parks manager, Rachel Callagher, says they've been working hard to upgrade a range of tracks all around the region, and they're regularly assessed and maintained.
At the moment, we've got physical work happening in the Waitakere Ranges on around 6 tracks, and that's about to ramp up very shortly. You know, there's going to be a lot more track available to the public in coming weeks and months. And at this stage, if things continue the way that they are, we expect to probably do more than 15 or 20 kilometres above what we'd planned to this year.
Ms Callagher says a few tracks will open very soon and others shortly after Christmas. Te Kawarau Āmaki, the mana whenua who implemented Arahui in 2018 to close the entire park, did not respond to requests for comment today.
Jordan Bond with that report from Tuesday's Checkpoint program. And finally, in the Week in Review, Wellingtonians may think they know a thing or two about gusts and gales, but the community of Castle Point, home of a howling southerly and wind-whipped sand, would like a word. On Wednesday, historian Redmer Yiska told Morning Report he thinks Wellington needs to give a specific name to the city's torment.
Māori were always too smart to live here, really, except in very small numbers, because some people say this place is actually uninhabitable, but that's probably unfair. I mean, I think we need a lot better names than the northerly or the southerly, which is the ones that we tend to hear.
Wellington gets winds over 63 kilometres an hour, 166 days a year. But Castle Point comfortably or uncomfortably bests that. Gusts of at least 63 kilometres an hour happen on average 227 days a year. And on 102 of those days, the gusts are over 96 kilometres an hour. Joe Vermeer runs the Castle Point Beach store and Anders Crowfoot owns Castle Point Station. They join Corin Dan on Thursday's program.
How's the wind there this morning?
We've got a mild 25 knots, I would say.
Oh, that, you count that as a still day, wouldn't you?
Not too bad.
Joe, do you have a name for your wind?
Not really a name. That's just windy. You know, it's just the Castle Point wind.
How bad is it? Give us a sense.
How bad is it? For someone coming in during the week, they'll be like, wow, this is windy, like today, and I sort of look out and just go, no, that's not windy. It's not windy at all. I think this month has been pretty bad. Last night, I think we had a gust of 140, and it didn't seem that windy because earlier in the month, I think there was a gust of 190.
So, Anders, I'm guessing you don't have the trampoline loosely lying around the backyard?
No, we used to have one. It did end up on the roof at one point.
Well, so what do you have to do when you live in a place with that much wind? Does it affect you?
You get used to it, or you move away, I think.
So you've got used to it, so what constitutes a windy day for you then?
I only somewhat joking says don't ask me if it's windy till it's over 120K, because it doesn't really seem that strong.
And with all seriousness, do you have to batten things down a bit more than you would normally?
Yeah, I like sliding doors rather than ones that swing, because they don't go bashing around. And it's interesting, having emigrated from the States, I mean, the winds we get here would have absolutely devastated where I came from, and we'll have 160K breezes, and there are a few leaves here and there, but the trees have all sort of grown up to it, and it's amazing how little damage actually gets done.
Joe, what's the worst wind here? Is it the big cold southerly coming up from Antarctica, or is it that persistent nagging northerly?
Look, the southerly, along the front, the southerly, you don't really get affected at all. When you go around the corner to the gap, it's pretty horrific. But I think it's the dry, hot nor-west wind. It's, sand drilling through your legs isn't that much fun when you're walking down the beach with your kids.
But Anders, I think this is Wellington might have something here, because when we get that nor'wester, often it's just cloud. Do you at least get sunlight?
It's usually pretty sunny. If it's windy, it tends not to be cloudy.
Anders Crowfoot, who owns Castle Point Station, and before him, Joe Vermeer, who runs the Castle Point Beach Store, both speaking on Morning Report. And that ends this edition of The Week in Review. The next program will be available to download next Friday evening, New Zealand time. You can also catch up on the week's sporting highlights in the podcast Extra Time from RNZ Sport. All podcasts at rnz.co.nz. For now, from me, Paul Brennan, kia pai te wiki, have a great week.